Aloha. It is Tuesday, April 30th. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Is there hope to save a bill? Some say is needed to stabilize our energy economy. A bill to help Hawaiian Electric securitize rates to minimize risk for future wildfires hangs in the balance. We take a closer look at the One Ohana Fund. Its deadline is pushed off for another month. And teaching financial literacy, what Eva Beach students are learning and how their teachers are instilling financial discipline. And NPR launches a new podcast. It's called Wildcard. We learn about what makes it different. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning we talked to State Senator Jared Keohokalole, who last week deferred a bill aimed at financing bonds for Hawaiian Electric Company to help reduce future risk for wildfires. Is there a way to save the measure from dying as the legislative session is to end on Friday? Hopes to get the conference back in session yesterday didn't materialize. Here's Keohokalole.
The status right now is that the bill is deferred. We adjourned the legislative session on Friday, and that's it, as far as I know.
And explain your position in holding the bill.
The measure proposed to allow HECO to borrow money based off of a fee that they would seek approval for from the Public Utilities Commission, which is their regulator. This fee would be applied on the front of basically every ratepayer's Hawaiian Electric monthly electric bill for the next 30 years. The reason the bill was deferred is there wasn't sufficient clarity from Hawaiian Electric as to how big that fee would ultimately be, what the total number of money was that they needed based off of that fee, and what they actually wanted to use the money for. There were a variety of things they wanted to do with the funds, and there were a range of different amounts of money that they were asking for. And so the bill just wasn't ready because there wasn't sufficient clarity on how much it would cost, how much money they needed, and what they needed it for.
And I know there was some concern that something needed to be put in place for future wildfires. And we have to have some mitigation plan. And there's some concern that not having this could hasten the company going into bankruptcy.
You know, this bankruptcy conversation really is new, and in my mind has nothing to do with what was proposed in the bill. You know, initially, the proposal that was put forward in the bill was to use the proceeds from this fee on the front of the ratepayer's bill to conduct wildfire mitigation planning, which is things like hardening the grid, undergrounding electrical wires, replacing old poles, vegetation management, purchasing drones to do wildfire risk assessment. The status of HECO's solvency is going to be made clear when the ATF completes its causation investigation, and it's probably years from now when the lawsuits around the wildfires are settled. You know, until then, there is no assurance that this bill will prevent HECO from eventually or potentially filing for bankruptcy. It's just a separate issue. There was no assurance in the bill that that was what the bill was for. There was no assurance in the bill that the bill did not propose that HECO stay locally owned and controlled. And there were no protections provided for the workers at HECO in the bill. So, you know, for this conversation to be coming up after we deferred the measure is, you know, troubling, because the bill was just not going to solve that. You know, a bailout would solve that, but that's not what was proposed in the bill. And that was never put forward by HECO to begin with, in fairness to them.
So then, to be clear, at this point, this is not something that you feel comfortable or ready to entertain?
You know, it's not a no for me on securitization. Again, the point was to provide low interest funding for HECO to implement wildfire mitigation, which is something that everyone agrees with. The Public Utilities Commission, their regulator, has already ordered every public utility to initiate and submit wildfire mitigation plans in a public docketed process where they will be approved by the PUC, and we'll have a transparent understanding of what the plan is going forward and how much it's going to cost. Where are we going to underground electric wires? Where are we not going to because it's not financially responsible? How did they get to those decisions? That type of granularity and detail will be provided for probably by the time we get back into the legislative session next year. So at that point, we'll know what a top line cost of mitigation is going to be. We'll know what work will be proposed and where, and we'll have a better understanding of what people will be paying for in that fee on the front of every ratepayer's bill for the next 3 decades.
So you just want to know what you're committing the taxpayers to.
That's right. If we had better information, then we could have, I think, a more responsible discussion on it. And these things are going to take time. They're incredibly complicated. And so, you know, I just didn't think it was responsible for us to saddle ratepayers with this commitment without sufficient information.
Are there discussions ongoing now about a special session at all?
You know, I have not been a part of any discussions about a special session. I have my doubts about whether that's something that the legislature is going to consider. And again, I think we're potentially mixing up two different discussions. You know, if we're talking about funding for wildfire mitigation that everyone agrees should happen, that's one issue. If we're talking about the state of Hawaii getting involved in preventing HECO from going bankrupt, that's a separate discussion that I haven't been a part of.
And I know when we had those special PUC hearings on NextEra coming into the market, you know, that was a concern by lawmakers about having control over our utility, you know, offshore. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I would question the amount of local ownership and control we have in HECO right now after the turnover of their stock price. And ultimately, I agree. I do not want HECO to go bankrupt. And it is very important that we maintain local control of our electrical utility and the grid. But what exactly are we being asked to do to ensure that? It's not clear.
Okay. And so in your mind, there's no way that this will get resurrected before Friday?
Well, anything can happen in the legislature. But in my mind, we're just not ready to have these conversations until that are going to, again, commit consumers and ratepayers for the next 30 years without more information.
And did you ask for additional information, you know, when, you know, you had these reservations to give HECO time to
Absolutely.
Come up with it?
You know, there were 6 different bills that were introduced, 3 on the House side, 3 on the Senate side. Those measures are public record on the legislative website. The testimony that was submitted during probably 8 or 10 hearings, public hearings during the legislative session. All of the testimony is available publicly online. All of the hearings were broadcast and are archived on YouTube. We had an additional informational briefing 2 weeks ago where HECO presented for 3.5 hours. The whole process was public. So people can go on and they can watch the proceedings and read the testimony for themselves. We just weren't given the numbers. And it's, in my mind, not responsible for us to overreact without sufficient information.
That was State Senator Jarrett Kioho Kalole, who says he's not had any additional information from HECO since the Thursday meeting. At the time, Hawaiian Electric said it was disappointed with the outcome. It added, without moving forward with the right solutions in place, would result in higher costs for customers and constrain our ability to move quickly to mitigate risk and advance important safety work. It did not respond to questions about any additional info it could provide to allay the senator's concerns as of news time.
More more than 6 months since the October Hamas attack on Israel. Still no deal on hostages. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza. With no peace in sight, what do ordinary Israelis want from their leaders?
Everybody went back to their business, to their jobs and so on and so forth, but they're still shut up.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from PRX's Monumental, a new podcast confronting the reality of what's publicly commemorated and exploring questions about the past, present, and future of monuments. PRX.org/monumental.
You know, today would have been the deadline for families who lost loved ones who were injured in the Maui wildfires to sign up for the One Ohana Fund and settle their claims. But the governor extended it another month. HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us with more on that during this last week of the legislative session. Good morning.
Good morning. So the One Ohana Fund, you know, is a $175 million settlement program for families of the 101 people who were killed in last year's Maui wildfires, or for people who were hospitalized and severely injured. Hawaiian Electric is the largest contributor of the fund at $75 million. The state is putting in $65 million, and Kamehameha Schools is putting in $17.5 million, and then it kind of goes down the list from there. Surviving family members of wildfire victims could get $1.5 million if they decide to take this settlement. The amounts for those who are injured, though, will vary kind of depending on the number of days they were hospitalized, and that's going to be largely decided by the administrator of the fund, Judge Ron Ibarra. They're not really sure how many people would qualify for the serious injury claim, and that's kind of why they haven't set a specific amount yet for those who were injured. But they do know that 20 people were airlifted to Oahu during that time, and so they're trying to see, you know, how many people would register for injury to figure out how much those people could potentially get in a settlement. So the deadline to register for the settlement fund was originally set for today, but it's extended now to the end of May after, you know, there were several requests from potential claimants and attorneys for an extension. And as of Monday afternoon, there were 40 registrations for wrongful death claims and 11 for serious physical injury claims. So people have until May 31st to register for the settlement, and then they have till July 1st to put in the completed claim forms. And then after submitting their formal application, they will need to go to probate court, get a personal representative appointed, and make sure all the heirs are in agreement, and then they sign a release, and that's when they'll get a check. So the wrongful death claimants will probably be getting their checks late summer, early fall, and personal injury ones will probably come out in early summer. The reason that wrongful death takes a little longer than the injuries is because they need to go to probate court and get a personal representative appointed. The state didn't really have a number in mind going into how many people would take this settlement, but they're expecting to get at least half of the families who are eligible for wrongful death to take this settlement.
And you talk to a number of lawyers who say that, yeah, that their clients don't really want to apply for this, right? They think they should be getting more than that $1.5 million.
Right. We talked to a few lawyers, and some of their opinions kind of varied on it. One of the lawyers we talked to, Michael Watts, he's a Texas-based attorney who's part of a team representing 29 victims' families. He said only one of those families has communicated interest to him in taking that settlement, and he's over his career represented over 20,000 people who've been impacted by utility-caused wildfires nationwide. And he says it's not necessarily the concept of the One Ohana Fund. It's a good idea to have a One Ohana Fund, but it's just underfunded.
They're offering a pittance for these death cases, far less than what death cases have gotten in previous wildfire cases. And I say that not to be critical of the governor. I'm very pleased that the governor has gotten involved within months and trying to get the process started. So I think it's a good start. It's just not the solution. There's not enough money there.
And, you know, we also spoke to Lance Collins, a Maui-based attorney who's also representing families. And he says people who go through litigation could be looking at awards of $30 to $40 million compared to the $1.5 million One Ohana Fund settlement.
many people just have to think, okay, what is the value of a young parent who is working full time and basically has their full adult life to work in front of them and to raise a family? You know, what is the value of something like that? Or what is the value of a child who basically will not have a life at all?
And, you know, Colin says some families also want to share with their fellow community members on the jury about the impact of their lost loved one through litigation. But, you know, also on the same hand, for some of the same reasons that they've talked about here, people have decided to take the One Ohana Fund settlement. Richard Sakota is a Honolulu-based attorney who has a client who registered. He says the victim's background played a large role in the family's decision to take the settlement.
She was in the 80s, so their thinking was, even if they went to a lawsuit and they took into the factors about who she was, her education, her profession, that would affect the lawsuit. And I think the most important thing for them was when they said, if we go through the lawsuit, we keep living that her death for that period of time.
And he says litigation can take 3 years or more, and it could get appealed, and then so it could go on for a long period of time, and that the ruling would have to be at least $3 million to match the amount of the One Ohana Fund settlement after all the court costs and attorney fees. But if for people who want to register who would qualify or want to know more information, they can go to MauiCompensationFund.com.
And then this doesn't preclude people from trying to go after for property damage, right?
Yeah, it's completely, completely separate. Like, this is only for wrongful death or serious injury. And I believe for the serious injury, you have to have been hospitalized during that time.
Okay. So, gosh, with just a few more days of session, what are some of the big issues that have been settled or not?
Yeah, a lot has been going on at the legislature in the last 2 weeks, kind of shifting gears here. And there's a lot of different bills that have survived through session and others that have died. So let's maybe talk about at first the ones that are still kind of alive. And the big one is the short-term rental bill that would have allowed counties to limit short-term rentals or have more control over it. That bill has made it through conference and is probably going to be voted on tomorrow morning. So that was one of the big initiatives from the governor and the ledge that they wanted to take up, and that made it through. And so it's trucking along into the last final reading. And the governor has verbally said that he would sign the measure if it passes. Another bill that went through is an income tax bill, which basically moves the brackets for salary for income tax so that people who maybe are making, you know, on the lower end but have had increases are not getting hit with moving into a higher tax bracket and getting hit with those taxes. The housing density bill that has been pretty controversial in counties has also made it through. However, a lot of it has been watered down. They've removed the most controversial part of the measure that would have allowed two ADU lots on lots as small as 2,000 square feet. They're giving the counties a little bit more wiggle room to decide how they would like to like implement something like this. So that's continued along. And there was another bill about condo insurance that has, instead of making a whole condo insurance scheme for the state, they've turned into a task force to study it, and so that's moving through as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know the governor had said that if they didn't pass something substantial, that he might think about calling folks back in for a special session, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Pretty volatile right now.
Yeah. And the ones that are not passed that are dead that we've talked about, although nothing's ever dead till the very end, as we all know, is paid family leave. Climate impact fee that Governor Josh Green had wanted has not made it through. The estate tax bill that had been controversial that would have given more tax breaks to big estate tax breaks. And then the wildfire bills that you heard earlier about Senator Keoho Kalole talking about. So that would be the HECO securitization bill and the wildfire relief fund that would have given property owners essentially a settlement thing.
Okay. All right. And a couple more days to go. So
yeah,
we'll have to see. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ashley. We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizuo. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
invited to HPR Generation Listen's Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to 6 public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company since 2005, featuring a locally based customer care team committed to problem solving and personal service for each client. Learn more at mobi.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're going to test your knowledge on an upcoming Japanese celebration, the Iris Festival, which features colorful carp-shaped windsocks called koi nobori. You may have noticed them going up in your neighborhood, or perhaps you've raised a carp streamer yourself. Traditionally in May, Japan celebrates the health and happiness of boys by flying a blue carp for each boy in the home. This cultural tradition was brought to Hawaii by the early Japanese immigrants. The flying of the carp symbolizes each family's hope that their sons grow up healthy and strong. May 5th is also called Children's Day, where cultural foods eaten include rice cakes with sweet beans wrapped in oak leaves and steamed sweet rice wrapped in bamboo leaves. Modern families no longer just fly blue carps for the sons in the family, so for today's backyard quiz, we want to know who the black, red, and orange koi represent. Think you know? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NereitHawaii.com.
This happens to be Financial Literacy Month, and so we're highlighting a 30-year-old program operating in our public schools, the Student Operated Credit Union. It's a partnership with Hawaii USA Federal Credit Union, and it teaches students healthy spending habits and the importance of saving money, all good discipline. This year marks the first time the program is being implemented at the elementary, middle, and high school campuses within the same community, Ebba Beach. Mary Tess Galimgam is the Academy Coordinator at Campbell High School. The conversation's Masa Subiono talked with her about how students benefit from the program.
There wasn't anything like this when I was in high school. Can you talk about how this program works?
Yeah, sure. There wasn't anything like this when I was at high school either, and I'm a graduate of Campbell High School. We actually have 5 career academies at our school. So this partnership came about when we were building our advisory boards. So advisory boards consisting of community and business partners that are advising our teachers actually on what our students may need when they go out into the workforce or into post-secondary studies or careers. So this credit union started off as a partnership there where the teachers were getting some advice from the business partners on what to teach in the classes. So we have an entrepreneurship program of study at our school where students who are interested in the business fields take classes every year to learn about what that world might look like when they leave. So it eventually blossomed into the students having the experience of running their own credit union, because part of entrepreneurship is having finance background, marketing background. Eventually, they're hoping to open up a pop-up shop. So learning about how to build that business came with learning about financial management, financial literacy. And so the students who are involved in this credit union learned all of that first. And then now as juniors and seniors, they run the entire credit union.
It seems like financial literacy is maybe not something that our public schools had such a big emphasis on years ago, but it seems to be something that they're coming around to incorporating more into the curriculum. Do you feel like there has been a shift in public education where financial literacy is of much more importance?
Yes, I think so, especially since our students have that choice now. We're trying to open up more doors for them in their career options and their post-secondary studies. So knowing where to invest their money and how to make their lives sustainable, I think, is something that the students were really interested in. So one year we did an exit survey with all of our seniors, and the seniors actually said, I wish that we learned this before we graduated so that we could be responsible as adults. I think we put a lot of emphasis in the past 20 years on going to college and paying for college, but then students ended up having that burden afterwards. So they wanted to know how they can best use their money for the goals that they have. So it actually came from the students' idea. And then our teachers were willing to support that, because a lot of us came from that generation where we didn't really learn what to do and we took a lot of risks.
Have you seen some specific instances of how it's benefited students that you've come across? Like, have you run into a former student who had some feedback for you, said, thank goodness I had this education?
I think we have yet to see those return our investment with our students. We do see our seniors saying, you know, this is not just for seniors, that they should really be learning this at younger levels. So we're trying to embed it more in our 10th grade curriculum. So we have advisory every month. We have an advisory lesson where students are pulled out to learn other things, you know, career and college preparedness. And so these lessons are embedded into that monthly meeting. I think we're getting a lot of advice from our students about how early it needs to go. And so from there, we had it go into our elementary school. So the feeder elementary school into Campbell High School has their student operated credit union now. So it's amazing. If you ever get a chance to visit, there's fourth graders running the credit union there. Our middle school is also running a credit union.
What are kids learning at the youngest level, and how does it build on that as they get into high school?
So I think there's two parts of it. It's the financial responsibility for the students, and then it's also the career and college preparedness. So they wanted to go into finance or they wanted to go into small businesses. So my kids, my actual children, are students at Eva Beach Elementary, and they just recently opened their own accounts there, and they're learning to save instead of, you know, putting it in a piggy bank at home and then cracking that piggy bank whenever they want a new game or something. They can't anymore because they're putting it into a savings that gets deposited at their school. So I think having that routine of saving is really helping students at a younger age to become more responsible. The other thing is that these fourth graders are learning to operate it. So when I went to visit, they were there greeting me at the door, asking me what services they can help me with. And they knew exactly where I needed to go and what paperwork I needed to fill out. And then when I brought our high school students there, I said, you need to see this elementary school. You guys need to step up your game. You need to be better. You guys need to be better at marketing. You need to be better at customer service, because some of those things translate into lots of different careers. I've seen our students went to the main branch of the Hawaii USA Credit Union, and they took a tour of all the different services they have and all the different people that were there. And from the security guard all the way to like the person who's at the safe, they were all very friendly. They needed to learn how to do that no matter what your actual job title is. So they're learning financial responsibility for themselves, but they're also learning how to just be responsible members of society.
One thing I know about teenagers is that they always want the next cool thing that's out there. How do you convince students to save money or to be diligent with their finances when so much of the internet and so much of social media is trying to sell them the next cool thing?
So I think teaching them that holding back for something better and waiting is usually the more responsible thing to do. I like that this credit union, you cannot actually take out money. There's no withdrawals from the credit unions that we're running at the schools. There's only deposits. So they have to do a little bit more extra work. I do know, yeah, teenagers that have Venmo, they have debit cards. They're doing all kinds of things. But I do know that there's a lot of students who are entrepreneurs on our campus. They cut hair for fun. They do makeup. They do baking goods. So I think they're learning. They have that entrepreneurship spirit. So knowing that they need money to start up something and then make more money off of that, they're learning to reconcile that with like all of their employability skills. We call them employability skills at Campbell High School. Their like resilience, their communication skills, their reliability skills, empathy. They're putting that all together with whatever their own goals and desires are. So teaching them that this long-term desire is more important than a short-term desire. And when we show them that, you know, that big goal that they have for themselves, they're more likely to save up for that big goal.
Who can participate in this program? Do they have to apply for it? Do they have to meet a certain criteria?
So we have, like I said earlier, we have 5 career academies. When students come into Saber Nation, they take a freshman success academy course, which is like foundational in different career areas. And then they go into one specific program of study a little bit more deeply. So the students who are running this credit union are in our entrepreneurship program. They've looked at all the variety of career pathways that we have, and they said, I want to go into business. And this is their end of the program project. So as juniors and seniors in like a work-based learning project, they're actually working while learning. So they're working this credit union while learning all the things they need to do to start their own businesses.
Okay, so students show interest early on, and if they get into the academy that includes this program, they're able to participate.
Cool. Yes, so they're the ones who run it. But anybody can actually open an account at our school. I pushed them to do the marketing. So they went around to different classes and they talked to different seniors to make sure that they open an account before they graduate. They talked to our security guards who are also opening accounts, our staff who have children in the complex who are opening accounts for their children. So I think we had a big increase in accounts that were opened with the credit union due to this program.
I know that this is a program that takes place at several schools across Oahu. If there was a student that was interested in this, but they don't offer it at the school that they go to, how would they go about bringing it to their school or participating in some way?
I think most schools are really responsive to what students want to learn. So I just came from a meeting with all of the schools in the Hawaii Academies Consortium. So that means all of the schools that have these academy programs. And if there's high interest in the school, they will offer that program. Then we'll just find the teachers to teach it. But if a student wanted to also just participate with the credit union, they have internship programs in the summer. They have internship programs for high schoolers and also for college students. I have several former students who were not involved in the academies program, but they went into marketing or they went into computer science. They started out working at Hawaii USA. So I know they're really supportive of education and teaching students the skills that they need to be in that industry.
With the Eva Beach Complex being the first to have this program across its elementary, middle, and high school, what is the hope for the complex? What do they hope to achieve by being able to instill this financial literacy across grades and ages?
Well, I came from Eva Beach and our demographic was a little bit different in the 90s. I think what they're really trying to make sure happens is that students will influence their families to be a little bit more financially responsible as well. Not just getting students into careers in finance, but that more families will be more responsible, will take better care of their financial wellness into adulthood. So we're not seeing so much debt, so much risk. We don't want to see homeless alumni. So just building that family mindset of being financially responsible, having savings. Like I see that a lot, that people don't have savings. And our students worry. They worry about their families' well-being into the future. And they want to stay here. So my hope is that it's going to change our community for the better.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mary Tess.
Thank you for giving me this chance to speak about our community.
That was Campbell High School's Mary Tess Galamgam talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about the student-operated credit union program now in place at Eba Beach Elementary, Eba Mackay Middle, and Campbell High School.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Kapulani Landgraf, Aua, a photographic installation about Lahui featuring 108 Kanaka O'iwi, now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, best-selling fantasy writer Leigh Bardugo. She's best known for her YA Shadow and Bone series. Her new adult novel, set in 16th century Spain, is about a young woman who can make miracles happen. But she's a converted Jew and has to hide that from the Inquisition. Bardugo's ancestors were exiled from Spain in 1492. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
Now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we told you about the Japanese celebration called the Iris Festival. Neighborhoods throughout Japan are decorated by carp streamers from April to about early May. Here in Hawaii, local families started celebrating this cultural tradition through early Japanese immigrants. The custom has changed so that not only are blue carp flown for each son in the household, but other colorful koi for the rest of the family. Traditionally, carp is recognized as a symbol of strength, courage, and success. And the different colors of the koi represent different members of a family. Black is for the father. Red or pink is for the mom, and orange and all other colors are flown for other family members. If you see the koi nobori streamers blowing in the wind, not only do the carp look like they are swimming, but these wind socks also mean summer is right around the corner. And we did not have any winners today. We stumped you on that. But that's the quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HPR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Fresh air, move over. There's a new interview show in town. NPR is launching a new weekly podcast called Wild Card, hosted by a longtime journalist and former Morning Edition host, Rachel Martin. But the show isn't the typical interview format. In each episode, the host draws from a deck of cards with some deep questions. And one more catch, the guest can turn the question around, putting the host on the hot seat. Take a listen to a clip from the first episode featuring comedian Jenny Slate.
Is there anything in your life that has felt predestined?
I guess, no, I've never felt that anything was predestined. Every now and then it feels like there's kind of a meteor shower and good fortune falls into my life like that.
I'm Rachel Martin, and this is Wild Card, the game where cards control the conversation. Each week, my guest chooses questions at random. Pick a card, 1 through 3. They're questions about the memories, the insights, and the beliefs that have shaped their lives.
It was the most positive experience of my life because I exceeded all of the limits of what I thought I was capable of.
This week, comedian and actress Jenny Slate is playing the game.
Well, I'm nervous. Why? Okay, whatever.
Okay, so this is our very first episode, and I want you to understand how this whole thing came about. I spent a lot of years hosting news shows at NPR, and I got really tired of covering stories that reinforced how bad everything in the world was. Basically, I was burned out, but it was also bigger than my job. My dad died unexpectedly, and my mom had died a long time ago. So I was feeling really empty and kind of lost, and I felt this urgency. Like, all I wanted to do was think through really big questions about what it means to be alive. What experiences make us who we are? What lessons are we learning over and over? What beliefs help us make sense of the world? And when I started opening up about all this to friends, I realized a lot of other people were also swimming around in these kinds of questions. So I thought, what if we talked about this stuff out loud? But I get it, that can be a little intimidating. So we came up with this idea for a game to make it easier. This is the way it works. We made this little deck of cards with really big questions on them. My guests pick cards from the deck at random, and then they got to answer the questions. And I am telling you, it's amazing what happens. They start talking about ideas and experiences that they haven't talked about before, and then I'm doing the same thing. And I always leave these conversations feeling better, that no matter how different we are, we're all working through the same stuff. And my hope is that this is going to happen for you too, that you'll find yourself thinking about these questions and how they fit into your own life.
And HBR's Maddie Bender recently spoke to Martin about what listeners can expect from the new show.
You got into some of your motivations for starting this show having to do with burnout and this larger search for meaning. What about this confluence of factors, the pandemic, things like that over the past few years have led people to be in this place where they are searching for meaning?
Oh, I think it's just all those things. The world can be a grim place, right? There's so much beauty in the world, but it's also the news is relentless, and the pandemic isolated us in such deep, profound ways, not just physically, but emotionally. And I think we're still trying to heal that larger psychic wound. People are looking for community in different places. I think I was doing Morning Edition as the host right after Donald Trump was elected. And again, the news was just like a fire hose. And then the pandemic on top of that complicated efforts. And I just got to a point where I needed to make my own change. And I wanted to shift my focus from outside in the world to really explore people's interior lives. Because also within that, I find a universal quality. And so much of the news feels like it divides us. And I really wanted to be in a place and have conversations about questions that we all struggle with to some degree or another. Every single one of us thinks about how we navigate life after a loved one dies, or, you know, what is the nature of ambition and what does a happy life look like? What does it mean to be a good person? And so I wanted to create a space that had space for everybody and where people could hear themselves in the conversation.
And where did the idea of the cards come from? because it seems like across, honestly, between like those conversation starter cards you'd see at a restaurant or like the New York Times questions to fall in love.
Right. I mean, We basically, and it's my producer Lee Hale and I have been thinking about this for so long, how to make these kinds of questions accessible, because some of them are heavy, right? Just the ones that I laid out to you there can get heavy. And I like that. Like, I will swim around in that all day long. But it's not everyone's jam all the time to exist to that level. And so we thought, what if we created a game around it, you know? So it had this kind of lighter architecture to it. And it really works because it, first of all, it gives people permission to go to places they wouldn't ordinarily go. You know, it gives me the permission to ask questions I wouldn't ordinarily ask. But when you kind of gamify it, it just, it lends a sense of fun and whimsy and spontaneity to conversations. And it's really, really working.
I guess on the flip side, though, has there been a time so far where you wished a particular card wasn't drawn?
100%. Well, I mean, to be clear, we have come up with all the questions in the deck, right? So it's not like they've just appeared to us. Like, we had agency, we wrote the questions. They're all questions that I want someone to answer, right? Any of our guests. But some of them I like more than others. And so when each guest comes on, you know, I curate it to some degree because I don't want to sit there. I don't have time to ask them all like 150 questions that exist in the deck or whatever. So I pick questions that I think would be good fodder for our conversation. But then within the game context, it's up to the guest to pick one, two, or three, right? And they can't see the question. They're just looking at blank cards. So they'll pick three. And I'm looking at one, I'm like, oh man, I loved one. I really wanted to hear them engage on one. But I sort of like that. It's like I've give up my power as the interviewer. And I just kind of have to surrender to chance. And it's so fun. And it's really liberating. Because often in news, you are writing questions that you're writing intentionally to elicit a certain answer from a person. You're actually reverse engineering a question because you know that it's going to lead to this place, or you really hope it will, because that's the issue you need to talk about. And I got tired of doing that, and I wanted to be surprised. And I am. I am so surprised often. And then we go to some crazy weird places that maybe I didn't even know we were going to go to. Maybe if they had picked the other card, I would have gone on a totally different path. So it's like a choose your own adventure thing that is wild and wonderful.
You know, I never thought I would hear a journalist say that they don't want to be in the position of having the power.
I'm done. I mean, I believe me, it serves its purpose and you're good. It is good when it happens. And I sort of wanted to be in it with our guests, you know, and I get to with some of our rules, right? Like they can skip one. So there's an escape hatch if they're not into a question and they can flip it on me. And so then I'm a participant too. So
I can imagine with a particular kind of guest, it ends up being more of an interview of yourself. Has anything come out that you didn't think would?
Oh, I had to make my peace with this when we started it. I have to be prepared in each time we do this game with someone that any of these questions could be flipped on me. So I'm fully prepared to divulge things, you know, and I guess to some degree, I was kind of craving that. When you're a journalist, it is not about you. It is not about you. And you need to compartmentalize. And oftentimes that's difficult because you're covering really tough stuff and you're talking to people who've been through incredibly hard things. And after 10 years of hosting NPR shows, I was tired of compartmentalizing and I just wanted to be me. And this is a place where I can talk about my own blind spots, my own anxieties, how I am struggling with just walking through the world like we all are, where I find joy and inspiration. And hopefully that invites other people in and they feel seen and heard.
As people are recounting memories or experiences, there might be other sides to some of the stories they're telling you. And is that something you've thought about?
Oh, there 100% are. And what the beauty of this, Maddie, is I'm not in the newsroom anymore. I don't have to worry about that anymore. And that was also a source of a lot of agita for me, is am I getting at the whole truth of something? Because you can't possibly know one conversation, no reported piece, no week-long reporting trip, no year-long series can get to the actual nuanced truth of a thing. We can do our darndest, and NPR does, but we just can't represent all that. And I'm not trying to represent the whole of a person either. That's impossible. How am I going to do that in 25 minutes in an existential game show? So that's not part of what I'm trying to do. What I am trying to do is to create some intimacy and some authenticity where it's also a respite from the news, where people can come and hear a guest who they think they know, some notable person who they think they get their public persona, and wait, they don't, because we're going to show you a different side of them that's revealing, and it can connect our audiences to us in a new way too.
Well, Rachel Martin, big mahalo for coming on the conversation. Thank you so much again.
Thank you. Take good care.
That was Rachel Martin, host of the new NPR podcast, Wildcard, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. The show premieres this Thursday, May 2nd. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow we'll be looking at how energy bills have fared this session, what survived and what didn't, and what do we know and do we know why. Share your feedback by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.